This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Hello, and welcome to Audio Journal's look at history from all points of the globe, a program that reports on what has happened, so we might consequently find out what could happen. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. I'm Tricia Droney, and for the next hour, we'll explore a variety of topics, including learning a little bit more about the Alamo. Also, how did the Odyssey shape how we speak today? And also, what does congressional succession look like when someone dies? We'll begin today with an article from the New York Times written by a variety of writers, one for each person, on a topic called These Eight Americans Shaped History. We Just Don't Agree on How. This was published on June 20th in 2026. To study the history of the United States means confronting that its larger-than-life figures are measured not only against the era in which they lived, but also in the unrelenting, ever-fluid march of time. New information crops up. Fresh moral concerns rise. Contemporary politics shape how we understand yesteryear's conflicts. Many of the country's rolling debates have centered on the legacies of its founding fathers, like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, who were slaveholders, or presidents like Woodrow Wilson, who led the country through World War I and established the League of Nations, but supported racial segregation. Just this year, a New York Times investigation found substantial evidence that the Latino civil rights icon Cesar Chavez had sexually abused young teenage girls for decades. Many of his memorials came down. And since returning to office, President Trump's administration has moved forcefully to advance its triumphant interpretation of American history. As America celebrates its 250th anniversary, the Times consulted scholars across the country to identify historical figures who shaped the United States and whose legacies remain debated, a demonstration of how unsettled American history can be. Historians spoke of people who made undeniable contributions in their time, but whose work pointed to the country's intractable debates over race, gender, and political violence. The historical figures below cannot alone tell the story of the United States, but together they help show how the fight over the country's narrative has played out over generations and how that fight continues. David Blight, a Yale history professor, said that wrestling over history has long been part of the country's story. America is and always has been an argument. It's an experiment. First on the list is the Minuteman, circa 1775. This was written by Jennifer Schlesler. On April 19, 1775, just as Paul Revere warned, the British redcoats arrived in Lexington, Mass., leading to a skirmish that left 8 dead on the town green. Next, they swept onto Concord, where local militia and specially trained Minuteman fired what is said to be the first authorized volley of resistance, the famous, quote, shot heard round the world. Today, a memorial to that battle stands near Concord's Old North Bridge, showing a nameless Minuteman dropping his plow and picking up a musket. That mythical image has appeared on coins, postage stamps, savings bonds, sports logos, and, since the 1950s, the official seal of the National Guard. But as the United States cemented its status as a global power, the Minuteman also stood at the center of an enduring debate. When does government become tyranny, and when are citizens justified in firing back? In the Cold War, the idea of the flinty citizen soldier peacefully tending his field but ready to pick up a weapon at a moment's notice was invoked in the struggle against the Soviet Union. In 1958, the Eisenhower administration authorized the Minuteman missile program, which grew into an archipelago of intercontinental missiles buried deep underground on Great Plains missile, quote, farms, ready to respond to a Soviet strike. At the same time, the Minuteman figure was claimed by the emerging right-wing militia movement, which cast the U.S. government as tipping into despotism. In the early 1960s, some Midwestern hunters founded the Minutemen, a loosely organized armed group with chapters across the country that raised the possibility of guerrilla war against the U.S. government, which it accused of surrendering to the forces of international communism. Another group, the Paul Revere Associated Yemen, or PRAY, urged all patriots and conservatives to arm themselves against liberals and reds who wanted to steal the 1964 election. Those groups and more recent successors drew on strains of conspiracy theory-minded thinking that go back to the American Revolution, when many colonists believed that a corrupt British elite was plotting to strip them of their traditional liberties. But scholars have emphasized that the original Minutemen were rooted less in individualistic love of liberty than in the densely communal world of 1770s Massachusetts. In his classic book, The Minutemen and Their World, the historian Robert Gross showed that Concord, compared with neighboring towns, was in fact slow to term the patriot cause. And the militiamen were a highly trained force created by a well-organized local government. The classic image in Concord Minutemen's monument is a wonderful symbol of the fighting man as a civilian, Dr. Gross said in an interview. But it's also a myth that is detached from social context and political organization. And the second American that is highlighted is Charles Curtis, lived from 1860 to 1936. This summary was written by Mitch Smith. When Kamala Harris was sworn in as vice president in 2021, some news outlets said she was the first person of color to hold that office. They were wrong. Nearly a century earlier, Curtis, who was of white and native ancestry, served as vice president to President Herbert Hoover. Famous in his day, Curtis mostly faded from public consciousness in the decades that followed. That obscurity, even in an age when identity and firsts have come to be celebrated, is in no small part because his legacy is hard to embrace for many Native Americans. He was a man of consequence and contradiction. In an era when Washington was almost monolithically white, Curtis ascended to the vice presidency without forsaking his indigenous heritage, even as he advanced policies that have aged poorly in the eyes of many Native Americans. Born before Kansas became a state, he lived with his grandmother on a Kaw reservation as a young child. After leaving the reservation, he became a lawyer, rose through the ranks of Republican politics, and served in Congress before becoming vice president. In his office, he kept, quote, Indian mementos and highly colored pictures of famous Indian chiefs, close quote, the New York Times reported. He also remained on the tribal rolls as a Kaw member, even when it was used against him by political opponents, and supported the law that granted citizenship to all Native Americans born in the United States. But Curtis, many scholars agree, also bears some responsibility for the decline of Native cultures, as he promoted assimilationist policies that many Native Americans today regard as having been deeply harmful. He was even the namesake of the Curtis Act, which weakened tribal governments and privatized ownership of many Native lands. Kira Vigil, an Amherst College professor who is Dakota, summed it up this way in an article for the American Historical Association. A man who sometimes voted against the best interests of his fellow Indians also achieved a great deal at a time when the odds were against him. And our third influential American is John Brown, also written by Mitch Smith. John Brown lived from 1800 to 1859. At the Kansas Capitol, Brown is immortalized, clutching a rifle in a larger-than-life mural. Places where he stayed have been turned into historic sites in three states. He has been called a hero, fanatic, and zealot, with dismissiveness, reverence, or some combination, for his willingness to kill supporters of slavery. How do we take measure of his devotion to the anti-slavery cause, for his campaign of violence against an institution that itself was murderous and profoundly inhumane? That question has followed Brown since the 1850s in the build-up to the Civil War, as pro- and anti-slavery settlers flooded into Kansas. Both sides believed Kansas could set the course for the country's future. After Brown and some of his allies raided the homes of slavery supporters and killed five of them in 1856, more bloodshed followed. Pro-slavery mobs sacked and burned Kansas towns. Bleeding Kansas entered the national consciousness. Brown escaped death in Kansas, but he found it in Virginia, where he led a raid on the armory at Harper's Ferry. He hoped the raid in what is now part of West Virginia would inspire enslaved people to take up arms against slaveholders. But no uprising materialized. Brown, badly outmanned and outgunned, was arrested and executed. In the generations since, Americans have revisited Brown's legacy. Henry David Thoreau called him an angel of light. After the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, some asked whether Brown had been the country's first domestic terrorist. And in 2009, on the 150th anniversary of his hanging, the historian David Reynolds called for Brown to be pardoned for his heroic effort to free 4 million enslaved blacks. That pardon never came. Next up is Booker T. Washington. Lived from 1856 to 1915. This was written by Clyde McGrady. There is something quintessentially American about Booker T. Washington's rise to power. His message of self-improvement slots in nicely with what many people believe about this country, that anyone can reap the rewards of meritocracy and even the deepest wounds can heal. Washington's prescription went something like this. Black people, with the support of white America, should focus on industrial education and material progress within their own communities, thus creating the conditions for social and political equality, downplaying demands for full citizenship and the humiliation of Jim Crow racial segregation. Washington's ideas have been revered on the right, championed by black conservatives like the economist Thomas Sowell and Justice Clarence Thomas of the Supreme Court. Today, there are even Christian-themed comic books featuring Washington's vow to, quote, permit no man to narrow and degrade my soul by making me hate him. But Washington's legacy is more contentious in other precincts. In the summer of 1895, when Southern racial terror lynchings were near an all-time high, as the promise of Reconstruction was being dismantled, Washington delivered a speech that came to be known as the Atlanta Compromise. He chided black Americans for intellectual pursuits. No race can prosper till it learns that there is as much dignity in tilling a field as in writing a poem, he said at Atlanta's Cotton States and International Exposition. In his most famous analogy, he said that the races could be as separate as the fingers, yet one as the hand in all things essential to mutual progress. As black people wept in the aisles, white women threw flowers at his feet, and white dignitaries swarmed him, according to the historian David Blight's Race and Reunion. Newspapers all over the country carried the address, and a national star was born. Until that point, many black leaders had refrained from publicly criticizing Washington, whom they admired, but they also resented his words. W.E.B. Du Bois, his most prominent critic, too, supported reconciliation. But, he wrote, Washington's propaganda gave the impression that the South is justified in its present attitude toward the Negro because of the Negro's degradation. Today, the Supreme Court's recent decisions gutting the Voting Rights Act and affirmative action, as well as the rise of white identity politics, are once again charging the debate about how black politics should be best organized. In the past, periods of conservative dominance have created opportunities for black people across the ideological spectrum to forge alliances with conservative forces. At the dawn of the 1980 Reagan Revolution, black conservatives, including Mr. Sowell and Justice Thomas, more than a decade before his confirmation, gathered to discuss how Reaganism could work to the benefit of Black America. It's not difficult, perhaps, to imagine a younger Washington-like figure emerging today to capture the country's attention. And the fifth influential American is Madam C.J. Walker, who lived from 1867 to 1919. This was written by Audra Birch. Madam C.J. Walker was an early 20th century African-American entrepreneur whose products revolutionized Black hair care, even as she grew critics. Amid the harshness of Jim Crow, Walker accomplished what seemed impossible. She built a hair care empire with thousands of Black female independent sales agents, helping many of them become financially self-reliant. She developed and sold shampoo and scalp ointment through her national network of beauty culturalists. By the time she died, Walker had become a philanthropist and self-made millionaire, the first woman of any race to earn the distinction in the United States, according to the Guinness World Records. She represented the possibilities in America, said Alia Bundles, her great-great-granddaughter and author of On Her Own Ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker. The first child in her family born free after the Civil War, Walker's remarkable journey falls in the rags-to-riches genre, but her legacy, viewed through a modern lens and within the evolving politics of Black hair, has been more complicated. In her lifetime and beyond, Walker was accused of promoting European beauty standards by popularizing the use of hot combs, which uses heat to alter or straighten the texture of natural hair. Adding to the controversy, Walker was erroneously credited with inventing the hot comb. The critiques continued for decades, especially during the natural hair movement in the 60s and 70s. Walker defended her products and regimens as intended to improve hygiene, scalp health, and hair growth. Without indoor plumbing, people then washed their hair infrequently, and scalp infections and balding were common. "Let me correct the erroneous impression held by some that I claim to straighten hair," she said in a 1919 Dallas Express article, adding, "I have always held myself out as a hair culturalist. I grow hair." Walker was born Sarah Breedlove to formerly enslaved parents in 1867 in Delta, Louisiana. Over a period of 13 years, she was orphaned, married, and widowed with a young daughter. She moved to St. Louis, where she worked as a washerwoman until she was 38 years old. There, Walker picked up tips from her brothers who were barbers, and she sold Black hair products for Annie Turnbow Malone, another pioneering Black businesswoman, before starting her line and eventually establishing three schools to train sales agents. In recent decades, new generations have discovered Walker. The U.S. Postal Service issued a commemorative stamp in 1998. She was the subject of a 2020 Netflix miniseries, and Mattel later released a Barbie doll. Her legacy is now seen by some in a more flattering light, centered in part on women's empowerment, says Erica Ball, author of Madam C.J. Walker, The Making of an American Icon. She said, "The amount of tenacity that she had, it is impossible to overstate." And the sixth person, American, who's famous, and famous for the influence they had on the country, is D.W. Griffith. He lived from 1875 to 1948, and this was written by A.O. Scott. Near the end of Spike Lee's Black Klansman, set in the 1970s, rowdy white supremacists gathered to watch D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation, the 1915 epic of the Civil War and the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. Lee, using a cross-cutting technique pioneered by Griffith, shifts back and forth from that raucous screening to a more sober gathering in which an elderly Black man, played by Harry Belafonte, recounts the lynching of a childhood friend to students and activists. The juxtaposition is a reminder that few movies in American history have been as consequential as The Birth of a Nation. Based on The Klansman, a novel by Thomas Dixon Jr., Griffith's film spurred the revival of the Klan, which would exert its racist anti-immigrant influence on American life and politics for decades to come. This film was not a fringe phenomenon. The movie, more than 3 hours long, was what we would now call a blockbuster, earning $60 million in its first year by some estimates. President Woodrow Wilson hosted a White House screening. Modern cinema had found a heroic origin story. When Griffith died in 1948, the film critic James Agee, writing in The Nation, wrote that to watch his work is like being witness to the beginning of melody, or the first conscious use of the lever or the wheel, the emergence, coordination, and first eloquence of language, the birth of an art. Generations of cinephiles promoted a version of Agee's catechism, consecrating Griffith as film's supreme technical and aesthetic innovator, an almost Promethean figure. Though he made other films before and after, including the tender Broken Blossoms and the bloated Intolerance, Birth has remained the cornerstone of his reputation. Its incendiary view of U.S. history was hardly ignored. As the revived Klan took inspiration, the NAACP and other civil rights groups organized protests and boycotts, which Griffith complained were an attack on his freedom of speech. Agee, clutching at straws, declared the accusations of racism unjust, but there is nothing subtle about the film's fantasies of black depravity or its celebration of white violence. And Birth remained in the canon as a kind of aesthetic test case to be admired for its form, or even, as it was mostly reviled, for its content. Sometimes the ideological passions that impelled a work into existence dissolve over time, leaving behind something that can be appreciated as art. This has not been the fate of The Birth of a Nation. If anything, it's the opposite. The breakthroughs of early cinema that had seemed to Agee and others to be the work of one man are now understood as the products of an emerging system of inspired collaboration and constant experimentation. Griffith's own work looks stiff and sentimental, weighed down with melodrama and grandiosity that may have seemed dated even in 1915. Other filmmakers from that era, including Charlie Chaplin, Alice Guy Blaschet, and Louis Weber, feel modern in a way he never does. Time has worn away the importance of the art. What remains, what seems, alas, less obsolete, is the hate. And next up is Phyllis Schlafly, who lived from 1924 to 2016. This was written by Vivian Yee. Schlafly presented an unapologetic vision of family values that resonates with many Americans to this day. When Donald Trump eulogized Schlafly at her funeral in September 2016, he cast both himself and her as underdogs, perhaps reasonably. Mr. Trump looked like the most long-shot presidential nominee in living memory. Schlafly, who gave him a rare early endorsement, had in the 1970s slayed the Equal Rights Amendment, which sought to give women equality under the Constitution, a seeming shoo-in until she got involved. By 2016, much of American life had turned nightmarish for someone like her. Gay marriage, widely accepted, abortion, legalized, gender-neutral bathrooms, commonplace on many campuses. Many women no longer measured their success in marriage and children, but in financial independence and personal fulfillment. These days, though, her arguments ring anew in our ears as a new generation of conservative women challenge feminism's gains. Today, anti-feminists hold powerful roles in Washington. Social media has gone frilly with trad wives. Their reasoning echoes Schlafly's. Homemakers enjoy special status, protected and provided for by their husbands. Why give it up? Decades before battles erupted over unisex bathrooms for transgender people, Schlafly warned that the Equal Rights Amendment would spawn co-ed bathrooms. Long before America First and Stop the Steal, the ultra-isolationist Schlafly accused shadowy kingmakers of conspiring to nominate America Last candidates for president. She tarred feminists as radicals, just as her heirs do now. To combat the ERA, abortion, and gay rights, she mobilized formerly apolitical evangelical Christians, helping to build the coalition of religious conservatives that propelled Ronald Reagan to victory and eventually ousted social moderates from the Republican Party. The political divisions that defined those 1970s debates only got more pronounced over the years, leading to today's hyperpolarization, says Marguerite Spruill, the author of Divided We Stand. And Shafley's tone had a lot to do with it. Shafley's victories came wreathed in paradoxes. She presented herself as a model wife and mother, breastfeeding all six of her children, yet she had resources. Her husband, a lawyer, came from wealth, and a housekeeper that allowed her to run political campaigns and churn out books, newsletters, and commentary. While exalting homemaking, she lobbied unsuccessfully for a top post in the Reagan administration. Calmly, she deflected accusations of hypocrisy, saying that she had raised her children before embracing what she called her hobby, politics. Career in homemaking, she said, came at different times in my life. Feminists never tire of leveling similar charges today against women like Erica Kirk, the conservative activist who now leads the influential organization started by her late husband, Charlie Kirk, and Katie Miller, the prominent Republican political operative who promotes motherhood as women's highest calling. Yet many young women are veering further left, and their conservative peers aren't necessarily sticking to homemaking either. At a recent Turning Point USA conference for conservative young women, several speakers openly discussed balancing family with high-powered careers. You could see Shafley's influence. You could also see feminism's. And finally, the eighth American who has shown such influence over the years was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She lived from 1933 to 2020. This was written by Jeremy Peters. Ruth Bader Ginsburg had attained folk hero status as the notorious RBG for her lifetime of legal work dismantling gender bias in the law. But her decision not to retire has put an asterisk on her legacy. As a young woman just out of law school, Ruth Bader Ginsburg found that no New York law firms would hire her. The federal government revoked a job offer after learning she was pregnant. The Supreme Court turned her down for a clerkship. Ginsburg, as a civil rights lawyer and an associate justice of the Supreme Court, helped convince the courts to dismantle the legal and societal structures that had kept this two-tiered system in place. But after President Barack Obama indirectly broached the possibility of her retirement during lunch with her in 2013, she demurred. That choice became a cautionary tale for Democrats who argue that too many of the old guard have selfishly refused to pass the baton to the younger generation. Justice Ginsburg's defenders say it's unfair to lay the court's rightward shift at her feet. By the time she died in September 2020, they say, the court had already grown more conservative with the arrival of two Trump appointees, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. The third, Amy Coney Barrett, replaced Justice Ginsburg in October 2020, and all three voted 2 years later to overturn Roe v. Wade in a case decided by 6-3. Her supporters argue that Justice Ginsburg would have had to retire before 2015, when Democrats controlled the Senate, for a reliable assurance that a like-minded replacement would have been confirmed. There was also the widely held expectation that Hillary Clinton would win the White House in 2016, not Donald J. Trump. Nadine Epstein, a journalist and admirer of the justice, wrote an essay whose title captures the debate over her legacy. "Why should you stop being angry at RBG? I am quite sure," she wrote, "that had Justice Ginsburg known the unexpected twist that history would take, she would have responded to Obama's inquiry differently." Ms. Epstein added, "A lot of us can say that about a lot of things." Our next article is entitled, "What Happens When a Member of Congress Passes Away?" This was written by Leslie Kennedy, and it's taken from History.com. It was updated on July 13, 2026. So, first question, how are deceased Congress members honored? When members of Congress pass away, the chamber in which they served honors them through various traditional practices. According to the Congressional Institute, These include lowering the capital flag to half staff on the day of death, the next day, and often until the funeral, a gesture mandated by law, not just custom. Additionally, Congress typically commemorates the death during official proceedings. Both the House of Representatives and the Senate pass resolutions expressing sorrow. Funeral services may be held in the Capitol, with some members lying in state in the rotunda, although this is a rare honor. Do the House and Senate follow the same protocol for filling vacant seats due to death? The process for filling a vacant seat differs between the House of Representatives and the Senate. According to the U.S. Constitution, if a representative's seat becomes vacant due to death, resignation, or other circumstances, the state's executive authority must call a special election to select a successor for the remainder of the term. The Senate follows a different protocol noted in the Constitution's 17th Amendment. If a Senate seat becomes vacant, the state legislature may grant the governor the authority to appoint a successor until a special election takes place. The specifics of filling the vacant position differ from state to state, such as the timing of the election or the requirement for the appointee to belong to the same political party as the previous senator. Five states require a special election. That's Kentucky, North Dakota, Oregon, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin. Their governors are not empowered to fill a vacancy by appointment. Next question, why do the House and Senate follow different rules? Procedures for filling vacancies in the House and Senate differ due to the U.S. Constitution's foundational principles. The special elections required in the House reflect the principle that the people directly elect its members. The original design of the Senate represented state interests, with senators initially chosen by state legislatures. The 17th Amendment allowed the people to elect senators and state legislatures to give governors the power to make temporary vacancy appointments. Last question, what is the widow's succession? The tradition of a, quote, widow's succession, where a wife succeeds her late husband in Congress, has existed for a century. Although the practice has become less common, it played a historically significant role for women's representation in the legislative body during the 20th century. 48 women have filled vacancies in Congress left by their late husbands through appointments or election. The first to do so was California Representative Maya Ella Nolan, who served from 1923 to 25. Margaret Chase Smith, a Maine legislator, who began her political career by filling her late husband's seat in 1940, went on to serve 24 years in the U.S. Senate and was the first woman to serve in both houses of Congress. In 1964, she also became the first woman to seek the presidential nomination of a major political party. Our next article is from History.com, written by Tim Ott in February of 2026, is entitled, What Actually Was the Alamo? Many people are familiar with the battle cry, Remember the Alamo. The reference to the 1836 clash at the Texas Landmark ended badly for its defenders, but served as an inspiration for the inhabitants of a burgeoning republic. Although casual students of history might recall some of the particulars of the battle, fewer likely realize that the Alamo existed for more than a century before this showdown, or know of what became of the fortress in the aftermath. Beyond the bravery shown by James Bowie, Davy Crockett and their brothers in arms against the superior forces of Mexican General Santa Anna, this centerpiece of San Antonio history began as a church, was used as a warehouse and general store, and at one point almost didn't survive to become the world-famous museum and historic site that it is today. The Alamo began its life as Mission San Antonio de Valero on May 1, 1718, established with the goal of developing a Spanish outpost on the San Antonio River and converting the local indigenous population to Catholicism. It took three tries for the mission to take root in the area. The first location for the mission is close to the area that was San Pedro Springs Park. And where you have springs, you have fresh water, explains Ernesto Rodriguez, the Alamo's senior curator and historian. Water from the springs and rain forced the mission to move south of where the Alamo is now located. Yet that area became into the crosshairs of a destructive hurricane. It knocks down the little structure that they've built, Rodriguez says. So then they relocate the third time to its present location, which is at the highest point in downtown San Antonio. Construction of a two-story convento, which contained the friars' sleeping quarters, offices, and dining rooms, commenced in 1724. A church began taking shape in the 1740s, but in 1756, some walls and arches for the not-yet-complete vaulted roof collapsed. Although its replacement was designed to feature twin bell towers and a barrel vaulted roof, the limestone structure was left unfinished. The three-acre grounds also included a granary, storerooms, carpentry shops, and irrigation ditches known as acequias. Surrounding fields were used for farming and livestock grazing. Sometime after 1758, inhabitants began constructing an 8-foot-high protective outer wall with a gate on the south side. After Mission San Antonio de Valero was secularized in 1793, the property was divided among its residents. However, the shifting tide of geopolitics that saw the nearby territory of Louisiana pass into the hands of France, then the United States, prompted Spain to organize a military garrison to defend its territory in the developing community of San Antonio de Bexar. The troops are sent from a town right at the Rio Grande called San Carlos de Alamo de Paras, Rodriguez says. The company moves into the secularized mission, and from that moment on, this place will be known as the Alamo. The Alamo Company converted the convento into what is now known as the Long Barrack, established the first hospital in San Antonio on the second floor of the building, and built additional one-story low barracks just inside the newly fortified southern gate. Although the former mission saw no direct conflict during the Mexican War of Independence from 1810 to 1821, the Alamo served as a base for members of the revolutionary Gutierrez-Magui expedition, and later as a Spanish prison after the 1813 Battle of Medina. The Alamo Company continued to occupy the fort until December 1835, when Mexican forces surrendered it to the insurgents of the Texas Revolution. Mexican forces then briefly reclaimed the territory following the Battle of the Alamo in late February and early March 1836. By the time the Republic of Texas won its independence the following month, the fort's outer walls were mostly torn down. The battle-scarred buildings of the Alamo remained largely untouched until 1846, when the United States' annexation of Texas and the subsequent Mexican-American War led to the compound's revival as an Army quartermaster depot. The walls of the Long Barrack were repaired and replastered as windows, doorways, and an exterior staircase were added to the building. The church, never completed during the mission era, was given its first roof, as well as the now iconic arch parapet above the front door. Following the conclusion of the Mexican-American War, the Alamo Quartermaster Depot occupied a key spot in the supply chain that funneled goods to more remote outposts across western Texas. Although the depot was confiscated by the Confederacy in early 1861, it resumed its previous function at the close of the Civil War. Around two decades later, a group of investors proposed a radically different idea for the Alamo. They wanted to knock down Long Barrack and build a hotel, a plan that horrified Adina de Zavala, Clara Driscoll, and other members of the Daughters of the Republic of Texas, the DRT. As the investors circled a deal, the DRT successfully navigated a series of political and financial hurdles to turn the remains of the old fort into a full-fledged memorial. In 1904, largely using her own savings, Clara purchased the Long Barrack from its private owner and deeded it to the state of Texas. After that, Rodriguez explains, the state basically creates a law that sets up the Alamo as the sacred memorial to the heroes that immolated themselves upon that hallowed ground. It has been a historic site and museum ever since. Following a bumpy transition under competing factions of the DRT, the Alamo underwent several renovations that began with the removal of the granite-embellished roof and second floor from the Long Barrack. The church received a new concrete roof in the early 1920s, while commemoration of the Texas Centennial led to the installation of the church flagstone floor and the cenotaph monument in the Alamo Plaza. Thanks in part to popular fare such as the 1955 Disney anthology episode Davy Crockett at the Alamo and the 1960 John Wayne movie The Alamo, the erstwhile fortress achieved a level of recognition that made it one of the best-known memorials in the nation. Designated as part of a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 2015, the Alamo continues to add new features to its grounds and unearth relics of its origins through archaeological digs, with the goal of ensuring that people will indeed remember the battlefield and other iterations of this colonial-era site in the centuries to come. The movie version of the Odyssey, a poem written 3,000 years ago by Homer, was released this past weekend. Many of you may have seen it. So in the interest of learning a little bit more about that period of time in history, these next two articles are about things that are related to the Odyssey. This first one was updated July 17th, 2026, is entitled How the Odyssey Shaped the Way We Speak. It's written by Gregory Wakeman. Composed nearly 3,000 years ago, Homer's epic poem, The Odyssey, is one of the oldest surviving stories in history. It's unsurprising, then, that a number of words and phrases can be traced back to the work, which tells the story of Odysseus' 10-year journey back home to Ithaca after the Trojan War. Along the way, he confronts and overcomes monsters, sea creatures, and gods, while his wife and son battle to keep his throne. Tracing modern expressions back to the poem is not always straightforward, and scholars continue to debate which phrases can genuinely be credited to Homer. The Odyssey was likely composed as part of an oral tradition and was originally recited in an ancient form of Greek that has not been spoken for more than 2,000 years. It has since been translated into Latin, English, and many other languages across the world. According to Jacqueline Neal, an assistant professor of Greek and Roman studies at Carleton University, it's hard to know what has come from a translator taking Homer's ideas and putting them into their language. What's not up for debate, though, is the longevity of the Odyssey. It speaks to the basic human experience, explains Daniel Mendelsohn, author of An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and an Epic, and his own translation of the poem. It's about the urgent desire to get home and to belong somewhere, as well as the competing urge to have adventures. That's something everyone navigates. The Odyssey gives us both of those contradictory urges and experiences. Here are six phrases and words that likely originated from or were inspired by Homer's masterpiece. And the first of those is Odyssey. The name Odysseus existed before the word Odyssey, says Mendelsohn. It came from the Greek word Odin, which means pain and vexation. Of course, Odysseus is a man who suffers a lot of pain on his journey home. Odyssey, which now refers to a long, adventurous journey, became part of the lexicon thanks to the success of Homer's story, and it's derived from the hero's name. The English word odyssey, which is used when we talk about someone going on an odyssey or an adventure, obviously comes from the title of the poem, explains Mendelsohn. Second, between a rock and a hard place. On his journey back to Ithaca, Odysseus travels through the Strait of Messina, the body of water located between Sicily and mainland Italy. There, he's confronted by two monsters. The first is the six-headed beast Celia, who dwells in a cliffside cafe and devours sailors in the water with her long necks. While on the other side is Charybdis, the daughter of Poseidon, who lives underwater and creates a huge whirlpool to swallow ships. In the years since Homer composed the Odyssey, the phrase between Celia and Charybdis has become shorthand for being trapped between two dangers. The expression remains common today. In 2021, the U.S. Naval Institute published an article entitled Sailing Between Celia and Charybdis, the Royal and U.S. Navies and the Specter of Decline. The idea that you have two alternates, both of which are terrible, is certainly dramatized in that episode of the Odyssey, says Mendelssohn. Since the early 1900s, between Celia and Charybdis has been replaced in everyday vernacular with the phrase between a rock and a hard place. Although that comes from the Southwest mining industry, it was also possibly inspired by Odysseus' impossible choice. Number three, in the lap of the gods. This phrase originated in translations of Homer's works as on the knees of the gods, an expression used to describe matters beyond human control. It appears in both the Iliad and the Odyssey. In the latter, Odysseus's son, Telemachus, uses it while reflecting that his father's return is up to the gods. That is an expression that comes from Homer. It literally means that your fate and your destiny sits in the lap of the gods, explains Mendelssohn. George Chapman, who translated the Odyssey into English in 1616, is credited with changing the phrase to in the lap. Number four, siren song. As he leaves Circe's island, Odysseus is warned by the sorceress about the sirens, mythological creatures who use their irresistible voices to lure sailors to their deaths. To avoid his fate, Odysseus orders his crew to fill their ears with beeswax. He then has himself bound to the ship's mast so that he can hear the siren's song without acting on its temptation. Although Odysseus does hear the song and begs to be released, his crew refuses, and they sail safely past the danger. Sirens and their songs have been used throughout culture to describe something that is tempting but ultimately dangerous. They appear in Apollonius of Rhodes' The Argonautica, in which Jason and the Argonauts encounter the alluring creatures during their voyage. Sirens also feature in Dante's Divine Comedy and in the film Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, demonstrating the enduring influence of the myth across centuries of storytelling. And number five, wine dark sea and rosy fingered dawn. Throughout Homer's epics, phrases such as wine dark sea and rosy fingered dawn serve as poetic markers, signaling the close of one day and the beginning of another, respectively. Both terms appear repeatedly in the Odyssey and the Iliad. The expressions have also endured beyond the ancient world. Derek Walcott, the Nobel Prize-winning poet, incorporated them into Omeros, his Caribbean reimagining of Homeric themes, while W.H. Auden referenced them in The Shield of Achilles. Patrick O'Brien also drew on the famous epitaph for his tale of his 1993 historical novel, The Wine Dark Sea. And number six, winged words. Homer regularly used the expression winged words when gods and heroes like Odysseus or Achilles speak. This term signals the importance and urgency of what a character declares, as well as the instant emotion and impact it has on the person hearing them. The literary phrase appears frequently in both the Iliad and the Odyssey, introducing everything from battlefield taunts and speeches to divine instruction. The expression remains one of the most memorable examples of Homer's poetic style. And on a lighter note, an article entitled Why Are Left-Handers Called Southpaws? This was published in August of 2025, written by Christopher Klein. The American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language cites the conventional wisdom that the word southpaw originated from the practice in baseball of arranging the diamond with the batter facing east to avoid the afternoon sun. A left-handed pitcher facing west would therefore have his pitching arm toward the south of the diamond. As the third edition of the Dixon Baseball Dictionary points out, however, that origin story is a little too simplistic. The earliest baseball mention of a southpaw, as found by Tom Scheiber, senior curator at the National Baseball Hall of Fame, appeared in the New York Atlas in 1858, but in reference to a left-handed first baseman, not a pitcher. Boston Globe baseball writer and former ballplayer Tim Murnane also recalled in a 1908 edition of Arizona's Bisbee Daily Review that a St. Louis newspaper had called him a southpaw in 1875 because he was a left-handed batter. Murnane adopted the term in describing pitchers simply because they were left-handed and not because they pitched the ball towards the sunny south on certain grounds. As Murnane pointed out, numerous big league stadiums were not oriented with the pitcher facing west. That was not the case, though, with Chicago's West Side Park. And it's theorized that Chicago News sports writer and humorist Finley Peter Dunn or the Chicago Herald's Charles Seymour made the geographic connection by calling left-handed hurlers southpaws in the 1880s. John Thorne, Major League Baseball's official historian, told the Wall Street Journal language columnist Ben Zimmer that he believes the term for lefties likely originated with a wholly different sport, boxing. In its coverage of an 1860 bare-knuckle prize fight, the New York Herald reported that left-handed David Woods planted his southpaw under his opponent's chin, laying him out as flat as a pancake in the ninth round. Even earlier, an 1848 political cartoon depicted Whig vice presidential candidate and future president Millard Fillmore lying battered on the ground after being punched by the left hand of a Democratic presidential candidate, Lewis Cass, and lamenting, "Curse the old hoss, what a southpaw he has given me." The Whig ticket of Zachary Taylor and Fillmore, however, ultimately delivered the knockout punch at the ballot box that fall by defeating Cass for the White House. And finally, from the National Geographic's book, An Uncommon History of Common Things by Bethane Patrick and John Thompson, a very brief history about the 4th of July, which we have recently celebrated. One weekday in an American city, a group of men agreed on a version of a document. This might sound like a rare but welcome occurrence in your own office, except that that day was July 4, 1776. The group was the Founding Fathers, and the document was the Declaration of Independence. Over the past 200-odd years, some people came to believe that July 4th was the day that the Declaration was ratified by the Continental Congress. That's not true. It was actually ratified on August 2nd, 1776. However, July 4th was the day that the colony's Second Continental Congress Special Committee for Drafting a Document that would formally sever ties with Great Britain settled on a draft of the Declaration of Independence. The committee included Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Roger Sherman, Robert Livingston, and Thomas Jefferson, who was considered the most eloquent writer and who drafted the document. Even though it wasn't made official for several weeks, on July 8, 1776, readings of the new declaration were held in Philadelphia's Independence Square. By the following year, July 4th had become the unofficial day of celebration. Congress was adjourned, bonfires were lit, and bells were rung. By 1791, it had become known as Independence Day. As time went on, other towns and cities held their own festivities, and these became even more common at the end of the War of 1812 with Great Britain. Despite decades of celebrations, Congress didn't officially establish Independence Day as a holiday until 1870. In 1941, it was declared a legal holiday with full pay for federal employees. Today, the 4th of July is observed nationwide with firework displays, military salutes, concerts, barbecues, and parades. And in a parallel history, the invention of fireworks. Now a staple of American 4th of July celebrations, fireworks were discovered in China at least 1,000 years ago. Some believe that their discovery was an accident by a cook who mixed charcoal, sulfur, and saltpeter. When compressed into a bamboo tube, the mixture exploded. No one has explained, however, why a cook might have tamped this volatile compound into a tube. The Chinese themselves credit fireworks to a monk named Li Tian and honor him each April 18th. We do know that the Chinese used fireworks and firecrackers, calling them yanhua and smoked flowers. They were thought to frighten off evil spirits. Genoese explorer Marco Polo and Christian crusaders brought gunpowder back to Europe, where many nations discovered a passion for firework. Before I sign off, just a reminder of a variety of ways you can listen to Audio Journal broadcasts. You can listen live. You can stream it from our website, audiojournal.org, or your phone through Zeno Media. Call 1-712-770-1043. You can listen with cable TV. Check out your local cable TV station, and you can find our list on audiojournal.org/listening with cable TV. Or if you'd like to receive a special receiver tuned to Audio Journal's frequency, supplied at no cost to our listeners, give us a call at 508-797-1117. You can also use a smart speaker where you ask Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Hey, Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or on your smartphone, find Audio Journal on the Zeno Radio app at apps.apple.com. Oh, no, you missed your favorite program? Look for podcasts on our website at audiojournal.org/locally produced programs. And don't forget, right after All Things History is at 4 o'clock, Backyard Bookshelf. At 5 p.m. is the Audio Journal Sports page, followed by 6 p.m., where we'll have a show called Science Journal. At 7 p.m., the reading of the Telegram and Gazette. At 8 p.m., USA Today. At 9, the Boston Globe. And at 10 p.m., Backyard Bookshelf Archives, and that will also play at 11 p.m. Backyard Bookshelf Archive. You've been listening to All Things History, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you'd like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call us at 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Tricia Droney, and if you're a history buff, we would love to hear your thoughts and ideas on an interesting topic for us to investigate. Thanks so much for listening this afternoon.
This is Bird Note.
An evening baseball game isn't the only thing illuminated by the bright stadium lights. High in the air, countless flying insects are drawn to them. And those insects are a perfect snack for the game's avian attendees. Common nighthawks swoop with their wide mouths open to hoover up the flying insects under the lights, performing aerial stunts over the athletes on the ground. Common nighthawks belong to the nightjar family, a group of birds with long wings and big mouths that are adept at hunting in the air. Nighthawks have gray and brown feathers that help them blend in on the ground. In the sky, though, these birds stand out. Vertical white wing stripes glow bright even at dusk and dawn, when they're most active. To show off for potential mates, male nighthawks use a display called booming. They dive so that air makes a loud boom as it passes over their wings.
Hot dogs! Hot dogs!
The next time you're enjoying your snacks at the game, Just know that the birds are enjoying theirs, too. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is sponsored by 7-year-old Quinn Sedgley, who wants everyone to help birds and wildlife.
Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week, including the Gardner News. You can hear the Gardner News every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Stay in touch with your community by tuning in to Audio Journal. The Gardner News, every Wednesday at 6 p.m.